to bioterrorism to pandemic flu. We coordinate the planning and implementation of statewide initiatives that are designed to prevent and reduce the burden of chronic disease. We identify and evaluate potential health hazards in the environment, from simple sanitation problems to the health risks associated with toxic waste sites. We provide sophisticated laboratory services, including techniques and procedures for screening biological and chemical samples that are available nowhere else in the state or in the region. And just as an aside, I would certainly like to extend an invitation to members of the committee should they ever want to tour our new lab building. I think you'd find that a very interesting experience. We work to help people lower their health risks by giving them information and support for making healthy choices. We safeguard the quality of our state's health care, and we regulate many of the people and institutions that are responsible for providing that care. We develop and implement strategies to contain health care costs while broadening access to affordable, high-quality health care for all Minnesotans. But improving health is not just MDH's job. It requires coordinated efforts on the part of all levels of government, the private sector, the community groups, and I would suggest citizens themselves. I'm sure you're aware that Minnesota consistently ranks as one of the healthiest states in the nation. One of the key reasons why we rank so high is because of the state's support for public health. I want to express my really sincere appreciation for the support that the legislature has given us in the financial support for public health in the past. And I certainly look forward to making a continuing case for your ongoing support as we move to the future. With a strong public health system and excellent medical care, we stand a good chance of remaining the healthiest state in the nation. So with that as a bit of a context and a background, I'd like to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Margaret Kelly, who is going to walk you through the financial aspects and our budget. Margaret?
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. My name is Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health, and I'm going to walk through two things today. We have members of our leadership team at the Department of Health who are also going to join me at the table to help explain some of the detail in their specific areas of the health department. You should have a handout with three-hole punch, Minnesota Department of Health base budget overview. We'll walk through this. You should also have a larger sheet of paper that has our organizational structure on it so you can see how we're organized and use that as we walk through our budget. I'm going to begin with the 8.5 by 11, if you turn to the first page, where our funding comes from, and walk you through the variety of funding sources that we have at the Department of Health. Our biennial budget for the upcoming fiscal years 2008-2009 is $864 million from all of our funding sources. And we have a variety of sources. First, the general fund, which we are going to talk about today, which is the main source of funding from general tax dollars, tax revenues. The majority of our funding comes from the federal government through federal funds. The third largest piece is from medical education and research cost funds. These are dollars that are appropriated to the health department, to the Department of Human Services, to the University of Minnesota, are funneled through financing mechanisms at the Department of Human Service to draw down federal match and federal financial participation, and they are all then granted out of the department to academic institutions and training sites throughout the state for health professionals. We're not going to be talking about that funding source at this hearing. Next is the State Government Special Revenue Fund, which is 100% fee revenues. We'll also be talking about that today. Many of our regulatory activities are funded with fee revenues. The Healthcare Access Fund we will be talking about today. It's provider and premium tax revenues that are then appropriated to a number of state agencies, including the Health Department. And lastly, Miscellaneous Special Revenue Fund and other funds are primarily contracts that the health department will have with other agencies or internal contracts that we have with within our agency ourselves. If you turn to page 2.
Yes, Senator Bretner-Solin.
May I ask one question, Ms. Kelly? Is the MERC funds under the purview of this committee or under the Higher Education Committee? Or
those funds are under the purview of this committee.
Of this committee. Will we be talking about them at some point?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
If you turn to the back side of page 1 on page 2, we have a pie chart here that describes where our funding goes, how we use that $864 million, or how we plan to use it in the next biennium. On the lower left, you see MDH operations, $327 million. That's about 38% of our budget. So roughly only one-third of our funds stay at the health department for MDH-based activity. The balance of our funds go out to grants to academic institutions, nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations, local units of government. And we've described how those grant dollars are awarded, the majority of which are WIC and MERC. And then we have a number of other individual grants, which we will be talking about later today as we move forward. Next, we'll begin with the Community and Family Health Division, which is the first division within our Health Community Family Health Promotion Bureau. And if you turn to page 3, I'm just going to describe in brief the funding for this activity, and Janet Olstead, the Acting Division Director, will walk you through the detail of that budget. The budget for the Community Family Health Division, it's one of our largest divisions, primarily because of WIC funding. It is $373 million for the next biennium. And three-quarters of this is from federal funding sources, maternal child health block grant, WIC funding, and TANF funding. Only 19% of the funds are from the general fund, which we'll talk about today. 89% of the funds go out in the form of grants to WIC participants and local units of government, one of our biggest grant programs, which we will be talking about next week when we're before this committee, is our partnership with local public health, and we support that partnership in part with financing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Olstead, the Acting Director of the Division of Community and Family Health. And I'm going to walk you through the activities that we have within that division. Through partnerships with local and tribal governments, healthcare providers, and community organizations, the Community and Family Health Division works to ensure a coordinated state and local public health infrastructure, works to improve the health status of mothers, children, and families, and works to promote access to health care for vulnerable, underserved, and rural population. The division has approximately 140 staff. The first section that is described on page 4 is the maternal and child health section. Maternal and child health works to improve pregnancy outcomes, enhance the health of pregnant and postpartum women, their infants, and children and youth. The funding within this area supports the manager of the section and 0.6 clerical support. Infant mortality. This activity funds one FTE, which provides leadership for department activities related to reducing infant mortality. Child and teen checkup. Under a contract with the Department of Human Services, this unit is responsible for statewide child and teen checkup education and training of health professionals and technical assistance to public and private child health care providers. This activity draws down matching Medicaid funds. MinEnable works with teens. It's a grant program which works with teens ages 12 to 14, their families and communities, to help teens learn refusal skills and to postpone sexual activity. The program uses a three-pronged approach: community organizing, curriculum implementation, and a statewide public awareness campaign. The MinEnable's website, SayNotYet.com, gives teens ways to take charge of their lives and say not yet to sex, and offers adults resources for communication with teens. We have 23 community grant projects across the state, which reach over 9,000 youth in 2006. This program was created in 1995 and is funded out of the general fund, but also receives $2 of every marriage license fee. The home visiting program provides support to local, public, and tribal health staff for home visiting activities they undertake with federal TANF funding. This includes providing technical assistance, best practice guidelines, and trainings such as the use of developmental assessment tools, maternal and infant mental health screening tools, and home safety checklists for injury prevention. FAS prevention grants. FASD is an umbrella term used to describe the range of effects that can occur in an individual whose mother drank alcohol during pregnancy. In fiscal year 2005, MDH began transition of general fund appropriations for FASD to MOFAST, a statewide organization that focuses solely on the prevention of and intervention with FASD. Funding is used to support community grants, professional education, public awareness and diagnosis, and intervention for individuals affected with a disorder, and support for their families. Positive alternatives. This grant program was passed in the 2005 legislative session and is designed to provide assistance to Minnesota women who are facing an unplanned pregnancy. Currently, 37 organizations have been awarded funding to provide a variety of services to pregnant women, including case management, client advocacy services, parenting, parenting programs, transitional housing, medical and educational support, and necessary items such as cribs and car seats. Family planning special projects. This grant program was established in 1978 and provides pre-pregnancy family planning services to low-income Minnesotans. Funds may be used for public information, outreach, counseling, family planning method services, and referral. Funds also support a family planning hotline. Over 100,000 individuals were reached through educational presentations, almost 5,000 hotline calls were answered, and over 27,700 individuals were provided with family planning methods in 2005. There are currently 42 grantees for this program. Family Planning Grants Greater Minnesota. The 2005 legislature directed $500,000 a year to family planning clinics serving outstate Minnesota that were experiencing financial need. A total of 15 FPSP grantees received additional funding this past biennium. Newborn screening follow-up. This activity is funded by a portion of the newborn screening fee. Funding supports staff that are responsible for follow-up of newly diagnosed infants identified through the newborn blood spot screening. Primary responsibility is to assure that families are connected with their primary care physician, specialty clinic, and other available resources necessary for appropriate support and treatment. The Promoting Perinatal Health. This was one-time funding, providing upfront support to the department in making videos available to hospitals on shaken baby syndrome.
Could I just ask you, are those videotapes also available to high schools?
Madam Chair, I would see that there would be no reason why they are not, but I believe the videos were... their video arrangements were made through the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Right. I just had someone call me last week and ask me if this was something that also was taught in the public schools.
Madam Chair, we can get back to you with that.
Thank you.
Moving on to Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs. Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs has one activity that is regional clinics. They provide comprehensive evaluations through specialty clinics held in Greater Minnesota and serve approximately 600 children annually. Specialists provide assessments, diagnosis, and plan of care for each child seen. Clinic types include facial dental, development and behavioral, diabetes, and habilitation and technology clinics. Funding within this area does support the mission section manager, part-time speech therapist, and most of the money rolls out in contracts for the variety of specialists who examine children.
Where are these clinics located at?
Basically, these clinics are held in outstate Minnesota, so we have clinics in Duluth, St. Cloud, Brainerd, Fergus Falls, Crookston. Thank you. The Office of Public Health Practice, under the director's office, provides coordination, leadership, and support to 53 community health boards so Minnesota's local public health system can respond effectively to a range of public health issues. Staff also provide grant oversight, administrative, and operational support, including reporting requirements of the Local Public Health Act. Local Public Health Act funding provides funds to Minnesota's 53 community health boards to carry out local public health responsibilities within a system of statewide guidelines and standards. It's a formula distributed grant. There's a required match of state federal fund, or there's a required match of state funds received of 75%. Current funding for the available funding is a little over $21 million within that grant program. Indian health grants. The grant purpose is to provide health service assistance to Native Americans who reside off reservations. There are currently five grantees. The migrant health grants supports health services to migrant workers and their families. We have one grantee, the Migrant Health Service. The Office of Rural Health, the director's office. The Office of Rural Health promotes access to quality health care for rural and underserved urban Minnesota. This area includes staff that manages the office's grant programs, conducts research on rural health issues, works with rural providers and rural communities to stabilize rural health care delivery system. The office manages an average of 175 rural hospital, clinic, and pharmacy grantees. The office also supports the Rural Health Advisory Committee and produces regular reports and studies on rural health issues. Statewide trauma system. Goal is to ensure that severely injured people are promptly transported and treated at trauma hospitals appropriate to the severity of their injury. Staff assist hospitals to apply for trauma center designation, designate trauma hospitals, and operate a web-based trauma registry for trauma information. The area of workforce development, the workforce analysis program collects data on approximately 100,000 health professionals. The program analyzes workforce characteristics and trends, which are widely used for workforce planning. The area also contains the loan forgiveness program, through which an average of 215 health providers are serving rural and underserved communities. The office coordinates placement of an average of 120 foreign physicians who agree to practice in rural and underserved areas. The summer internship program and health career and health and long-term careers programs support health careers experiences for over 200 students each summer and assist school districts and employers to offer health career courses. The Rural Hospital Capital Improvement Grants. This program provides an average of 20 to 25 capital improvement grants and 15 planning grants each year to small rural hospitals to plan and conduct capital improvement and other essential projects. Community clinic grants. This grant program provides an average of 15 grants each year to community clinics serving low-income and uninsured patients. Grants support clinical capacity to serve people with low incomes, reduce current or future uncompensated care burdens, or improve care delivery infrastructure. There are currently the division management and support, the last line on page four. It supports the division director and assistant division director's salaries. It also supports division-wide services such as IT, financial, and clerical support, and includes responsibilities in printing and mailing the Women's Right to Know informational materials, and supports the MCH task force.
Are there any questions about any of these activities? Yes.
I wonder if you would help me understand how you define the, for example, the rural area that would be eligible for these resources, statewide trauma system or rural hospital capital improvement grants.
Madam Chair and Senator, rural areas are typically defined by federal guidance for grants and are based on census data. Non-metropolitan statistical area is typically rural. Correct me if I'm wrong. Perhaps Mr. Schoenbaum can come and clarify that for us.
morning. Mark Schoenbaum from the Department's Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, there are more definitions of what makes a rural area than any of us would really care to focus on. Assistant Commissioner Kelly gave you one commonly used definition. There are longstanding definitions in statute that define eligibility for some of the hospital grant programs, and they focus on everything outside the seven-county metropolitan area. But often there's a different definition for every purpose under the sun. I'm not sure that that helps you a lot. But for the purposes of the statewide grant programs, it's everything outside the seven-county area. The statewide trauma system is a statewide program intended to connect all hospitals in the state, urban, suburban, and rural, into a coordinated system of trauma response.
Well, Mr. Schoenbaum, the Rural Hospital Capital Improvement Grants, has the department ever made a grant to a hospital that is no longer operating?
Madam Chair, I believe the answer is no. We have made a grant to a hospital that closed soon after the award was made. We had not dispersed any of the funds, and the grant was canceled.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any special funds identified for dealing with children who are born to parents who are addicted to drugs like methamphetamine, who have problems sometimes similar to, or different problems, but the same social and medical issues that fetal alcohol syndrome children are dealing with?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, while we do not have any dedicated funds for those children who are found living in meth environments, our home visiting staff and our maternal and child health staff are active with communities in regard to screening and assuring that those children get appropriate services.
Other questions? If not, why don't you continue?
Thank you. We'll turn to page 5 and move on to the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division, and Mary Manning, our division director in that area, will join me to walk you through the detail. Again, I just want to talk a little bit about the pie charts on page 5. Again, here in this division, federal funding is the largest source of funding for our activity here. The general fund supports 33% of the work we do in this division. And almost two-thirds, again, of our funding in this area goes out the door in grants, with only 41% at the department for activity, MDH-related activity.
Actually, the chart says it the other way around. It says 41% for grants.
Madam Chair, I stand corrected.
Good morning. I'm Mary Manning, Division Director for the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division. Madam Chair, committee members, the purpose of the Health Promotion Division is to provide leadership in the prevention and control of diseases and injuries. It monitors the public's health and evaluates and supports public programs designed to reduce the burden of chronic disease. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 75% of the $1 trillion spent on health care in the U.S. goes to treating chronic diseases. Many of these diseases, such as heart disease, diabetes, cancer, all can be prevented if people make healthier choices. In all the division's activities, the division strives to address the health status of populations of color who suffer the disability and die disproportionately more frequently from chronic diseases and injuries than white Minnesotans. The total division budget is $24.6 million. Of that, $14.1 million is from federal sources, and from general fund, $8.1 million. We also receive some special revenue dollars of in the amount of $2.3 million. I'm going to go to the first line, the cancer control section. The main purpose of this section is to support the SAGE program. Through a statewide network of over 370 clinics, they provide free breast and cervical cancer screening, diagnostic and follow-up services to more than 15,000 low-income women per year who are either uninsured or underinsured. SAGE Plus, a smaller federally funded program, allows us to expand that screening to do some heart health screening among a small amount of that 15,000 women. We received two federal grants that total $5.2 million for SAGE and SAGE Plus. General fund support for that program is $1,069,000, of which $542,000 is administration and $527,000 goes out to pay for screening services. One additional portion of money for this program is supplementary funds from Race for the Cure. At this point, we are receiving over $700,000 from Race for the Cure, which is very important. That's actually 10%, almost 10% of our budget. The reason these funds are so critical, along with the state funds, is it allows us to serve women 40 to 50 years of age. The federal funding for breast screening only allows to serve women 50 and older. The next section that I'm going to describe is the Center for Health Promotion. The center encourages Minnesotans to live healthy lives, make well-informed decisions, and develop healthy environments. It monitors state and national trends in diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and injury. We provide obesity prevention, physical activity, and chemical health support to various state chronic disease planning grants and support ongoing department activities such as STEPS, adolescent health, mental health, and school health. One of our largest federal grants in this area is Steps to a Healthier Minnesota. In that grant, we support four Minnesota communities. They are Wilmer, Rochester, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. STEP communities work to increase healthy lifestyle choices among adults through worksite interventions, community-driven environmental change, school-based initiatives, all with the goal to reduce the impact of asthma, diabetes, and obesity. That's prescribed by the federal grant. Another large federal responsibility that we have in this area is the Injury and Violence Prevention Unit. It operates a statewide surveillance system for all newly diagnosed traumatic brain injury and spinal cord cases. We provide data through the Minnesota Trauma Data Bank on injury, incidents, mortality, and trends. The total budget for the Center for Health Promotion is $6,360,000. We receive 11 federal grants, which total $4.3 million. We have general fund support of $470,000, and that special revenue fund that I mentioned that we received is from the driver's license DWI reinstatement fee, and that's $1.4 million.
And so do you also have staff that are funded out of the federal monies you receive?
Yes.
I think we'd like to get a breakdown for the whole department of staff that's supported with federal funding, if we could.
Okay. For the chronic disease and environmental epidemiology section, that's where the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System is located. The Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System is a statewide surveillance of all newly diagnosed cancer cases in the state. On a yearly basis, that ends up to be about 25,000 cases per year. We provide data on the incidence, mortality, and trends to help determine where early detection, education, and other programs should be directed. We respond to questions about cancer. We conduct special studies of the cancer occurrence. Examples of this would be in Prairie Island, when there was a high level of breast cancer around the nuclear power plant. We looked at the data there but saw that it wasn't necessarily related at all to the nuclear power plant, but worked with providers when we found from the cancer surveillance system that women were being treated later in Goodhue County than they were in other parts of the state, which when you get treated later, you're more likely to die from breast cancer. So that's the kind of information that we are able to get out of the surveillance system, where you might have thought that there was a different type of problem. Looking at the data in the MCSS led people to another conclusion.
And then after that discovery was made, were there changes in the practice patterns?
Yes, we worked with staff in the cancer control section, worked with staff in Goodhue County and other healthcare providers, along with local public health. And we actually did more outreach in that area.
And so have we seen the mortality rate from cancer decline then?
Yes, we have.
Thank you.
We also do special studies, as I mentioned. There are 30 to 40 studies that have been done with Minnesota data. One of the current ones, or one that's just recently being completed, is cancer, the relationship of cancer melanoma with tanning facilities. We're working on that with the University of Minnesota. We do a lot of studies with the university utilizing the data from the MCSS. One recent one is predictors of adult leukemia, which is allowing them to do some preventive work and better treatment. There also has been a study of the quality of life of cancer survivors, which we've done with the American Cancer Society. The other unit in the chronic disease and environmental update section is the asthma unit. The major focus of this unit is monitoring asthma, implementing the strategic plan for addressing asthma in Minnesota. That includes training providers, school nurses, and also efforts to reduce environmental triggers in children with asthma. The total budget for that section is $3,770,000. It's five federal grants totaling $2.1 million and general fund support of $1.5 million. The next line is the Tobacco Prevention and Control Office. MDH works to prevent and reduce tobacco use in Minnesota by collaborating with state, local, and national partners. All general funds are used on community-based interventions throughout the state and with specific populations. We have one federal grant for $1.2 million and general fund support of $3.28 million. In the director's office, we have a number of initiatives that are funded both with general fund and federal dollars. One of these initiatives is comprehensive cancer planning. Minnesota has developed a statewide comprehensive cancer control plan. This process has led to the funding of the colorectal initiative in Minnesota among Minnesota's tribal communities. It's funded by the National Cancer Institute, and we're the only state that received this funding. The comprehensive cancer plan has allowed the state to go after a number of different funds. They have to be applied through the state health department, but they're generally directed out of the health department. Another example is the Mayo Clinic was able to get a grant to study ovarian cancer because it was approved through this planning process. We have a genomics grant that works to incorporate appropriate use of genomic information and tools in public health planning, programs, and policy development in Minnesota, especially as it relates to chronic disease prevention activities. We also have an arthritis grant, which works with primarily the Arthritis Foundation to implement and evaluate arthritis self-management programs. And we work with state, national, and local partners to promote healthy aging. We also have a large grant in the director's office. It's the Poison Control Grant. We provide administrative oversight to the Minnesota Poison Control System, which provides immediate treatment advice about poisonings to the general public and health professionals around the state. The total budget in the director's office is $2,964,000. That's five federal grants totaling $1.082 million and general fund support of $670,000 in administration and $1.1 million for the poison control grant.
Are there any questions on this page?
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just an announcement that should be noted is that as a result of the direction of Ms. Manning and or the guidance of Ms. Manning at the direction of the legislature, Minnesota is being announced today as having the lowest incidence and deaths by of cervical cancer, and is receiving an excellent rating as a result of that. So I appreciate your efforts in working on those issues.
Madam Chair, Senator Solin, the state and the staff at the MDH really appreciate the support they get from the legislature, local partners, and the health care system in achieving that. That's very rewarding.
Either on this page or any of the others that you where you receive federal funding, is there a requirement that the state put up a certain percentage match in order to receive the federal grant?
For many of these programs, yes, there are.
Could we get that detailed information also?
Yes.
Are there other questions? Okay, then let's go on.
That concludes our discussion of the Community and Family Health Promotion Brochure, or Bureau, which is the, well, it doesn't conclude it, the green area on your org chart. The Office of Minority and Multicultural Health will be here tomorrow. We're going to move over to the yellow area, our Policy, Quality, and Compliance Bureau, and that begins on page 7 of, page 7 of your handout. And we're going to begin with the Health Policy Division. This division has $177 million biennial budget. Division Director Jim Golden is going to join me to walk through the detail. This division is primarily funded with Merck funds, and I believe Jim will have a small discussion of that. We didn't come prepared with too much detail. We thought we were going to deal just with General Fund, Health Care Access Fund, and State Government Special Revenue Funds, but we can prepare more if you have more questions. And because it is so heavily funded with Merck funds, it is primarily all the division's resources go out the door in grants. 90% of the division funding goes out the door in grants.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the Acting Division Director for the Division of Health Policy. This division is responsible for the collecting and analyzing of data that is useful for setting and evaluating state and local health policy. Overall, the division monitors and tracks healthcare access, cost, and quality data. It analyzes and reports on the healthcare marketplace and infrastructure. It promotes the adoption and use of interoperable electronic health records. It maintains the official permanent birth and death records for approximately 8 million individuals within the state. It monitors and reports on adverse health events, and it administers the Medical Education and Research Cost Fund, which supports medical education activities in Minnesota. The division as a whole has approximately 85 staff that are divided into 5 programs. As Assistant Commissioner Kelly mentioned, the overall base budget for the division is approximately $88 million. By far the bulk of that, 90%, is grant funding that goes out as part of the Medical Education and Research Cost Program. The remaining portion of the budget is the operating budget, is approximately $10 million and is divided across 5 programs. I believe on the materials that you have, the division is actually not on the next page, page 8. It is actually on page 10. Sometimes. What I'd like to do is just walk through some of the programs and give you a brief overview of those, starting initially with the Health Economics Program. The Health Economics Program is responsible for conducting research and applied analysis that monitors changes in Minnesota's market healthcare place and tries to understand factors that are influencing healthcare costs, quality, and access. This program is designed to serve as an unbiased source of information on Minnesota's marketplace, the analysis of the potential impact of policy changes, and as a source for technical assistance in the development of state health policy. To give you a sense, the Health Economics Program receives approximately 1,300 requests annually from legislative staff, state agencies, researchers, and the general public. The type of information that this program collects and reports on would be such things as overall healthcare spending and cost drivers, trends and variation in the health insurance market, the trends in the employment-based health insurance, as well as the small group and individual health insurance markets. This program is also the program that is responsible for performing the public interest reviews of any proposed exceptions to the hospital moratorium law. In addition to those routine types of data collection and reporting, this program also has the capacity to handle 1 to 2 in-depth special topics as are assigned by the legislature on an annual basis. As an example, in the last legislative session, we were asked to take a look at hospital uncompensated care, community benefits, and the value of tax exemptions, as well as to do a report on medical facilities that looks at such issues as what type of investment should be subject to prior approval, what decision-making should be used when providers are looking to build new facilities. All of these activities are supported by a fair amount of data collection from providers, health plans, and hospitals. All of this work is funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund. The overall budget for the Health Economics Program is approximately $2.3 million and represents 21.5 FTEs. As you can see on the page 10 of the budget sheet, it's really divided into two particular administrative pots. One is the Health Economics Office. This line represents the economists, policy analysts, and health services analysts that perform the analysis. And then the second line is the data and project initiatives. This line represents our survey experts, our data collection, cleaning and maintenance, our information technology specialists that support preparing the data for the analysts, as well as the capacity to perform the special studies as requested by the legislature. Moving down a couple of lines to the eHealth Initiative. The eHealth Initiative is an initiative at the department which promotes the adoption and use of health information technology, particularly the use of interoperable electronic health records in order to improve healthcare, increase patient safety, as well as to reduce overall health costs. The responsibilities of this particular program is to convene and staff an eHealth Advisory Committee, which is responsible for making recommendations to the commissioner regarding the use of health technology in Minnesota, policies and actions that can support the implementation of electronic health records throughout the state, the creation of a plan for communicating useful information for organizations that are interested in implementing electronic health records, as well as addressing policies that might be necessary to help ensure that the privacy and confidentiality of patients' records are maintained while we increase the ability to exchange them electronically.
Has the eHealth grant been made? Grants been made?
Madam Chair, yes, it has. I have a handout that describes kind of what we have done on that.
Madam Chair,
May I ask a question?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I've been trying to figure out, as we've been going through this presentation, what it is that we're actually focusing on. Because when you take a look at the amount of money that's within the particular division, the parts that we're addressing, the description on the opposite page doesn't add up to but a small proportion of that. So are we just looking at grants, or what is it?
We're looking at the entire department budget, most of which is federal funds, so I've asked them to separate out what are state funds and the source of those funds. Obviously, we don't appropriate federal funds. We do appropriate the other funds.
Okay.
And that's why I asked the question about requirements for state matching funds for the federal grants as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and Mr. Golden, it appears that you're compiling a lot of data, and I'm just wondering who has access to that data and who uses that data that once you've compiled all this?
Madam Chair, Senator, that data is all public data. It's all available through our website. As I say, for example, in the health economics program, we receive about 1,300 requests annually. They come from legislative staff, other state agencies who are looking at various policy-related issues, researchers, as well as the general public.
Senator Coring, they track, for example, all the health care expenditures that are made in the state of Minnesota category. So from year to year, you can determine whether patient procedures are increasing over the previous year, whether pharmaceutical spending is increasing over the previous year, whether administrative costs for our health plans and health insurance has gone up over the previous year. It's a lot of really useful data. If you've never looked at it, I encourage you to do so.
Okay.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Golden, there's been a lot of talk in the last year or so about the amount of the health care dollar that's being spent on administrative costs. And at least some of us have the perception that we're spending a very significant amount on administrative costs as opposed to direct patient care. Would it be possible from looking at your statistics to very simply discover what percentage of a healthcare dollar is going to costs other than direct patient care in various different programs, different types of healthcare programs throughout the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we would have that information. I don't have that with me available today, but we could certainly supply that to you.
Another question on the e-health initiatives. We appropriated $1.5 million, and what we're getting here under the e-health initiative is more than $1.5 million. So we think the 391 in the 607 budget is what we can't figure out.
Madam Chair, with regard to the 0607 budget, that includes the $1.5 million that was allocated last session. It also includes some funding that we reallocated within the division to support eHealth, the advisory committee, and those activities. In fiscal year 6, the health economics program was not asked to perform any special studies, so we used some of their capacity that would have otherwise been used to evaluate those studies to support the activities of the eHealth initiative.
Okay, so then for 08, does that show up back in the health economics office?
Madam Chair, yes, it does. And it also does in fiscal year 7, where we performed the community benefit study as well as the medical facility study.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions on this page? Do you want to go over the handout that you gave us on the eHealth Initiative then?
Madam Chair, yes, I can. What this does is this describes what we did with the $1.5 million that was allocated last session. $1.3 of that was allocated for the Interconnected Electronic Health Record grants. In July, we announced the grant program and put out a request for proposals. Those proposals were due October 12th of this year, and the grants were awarded on December 6th. There are two types of grants. One is a planning and readiness assessment grant, which was the grant that was up to $50,000 that helps organizations in their planning as they look to implement electronic health records or exchange with their partners. The other is an implementation grant, which was up to $250,000 for implementing electronic health records or health information exchange between facilities. What you see here is all of the grants. We awarded 12 grants. Seven of the grants were readiness and planning grants to help organizations around the state prepare. The other five were implementation grants. To give you a sense of how those 12 grants broke out by activities, four of the grants were for implementing electronic health records across organizations. Three of those were implementation for organizations that were ready to implement. Five of the grants were what we called interoperable health information exchange grants. Four of these were planning grants, and what they were really focused on was for organizations who may have already implemented electronic health record, how do you work with your partners to share that patient information in a way that best serves the patients when delivering care? One of the grants was a planning grant to look at how best to implement e-prescribing. One was an assessment grant, and one of the grants was associated with the development and use of personal health records. What is at the very back page of the materials is a map of the state that shows how these grants were distributed around the state. The intention of the grant program was to serve rural and underserved communities, as well as community clinics that may be in the metro area. Are there any other questions on the grant program? Anything else?
Any questions on the eHealth grant project? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair. Yes, I'm sorry, I missed your name.
Madam Chair, Jim Golden.
Okay, Mr. Golden. I'm still having a hard time understanding because I know that a lot of the hospitals have e-records, but they don't connect with other systems. And is it possible those that already have systems, do they have to develop new systems in order to be able to interact with other providers or systems outside of their network? Or are there ways that they can hook into these and so that they can speak to each other, so that patients' medical records can flow from one system to another if they're referred outside their system?
Madam Chair, Senator, that is exactly one of the challenges that is facing all of eHealth right now. It is true that most of the hospitals around the state at this point have electronic health records for storing their patients' data electronically. The issue in exchanging the information is a couple of issues. When you have the same type of system, the same vendor, for example, it is usually a lot easier to exchange the data, assuming that you've stored it in your system in a reasonably similar way. There, the challenges that the organizations are facing are primarily security and privacy types of concerns. How do we make sure that in sharing this information, that we're really only sharing it with the other hospital for patient care? And how do we incorporate the patient's wishes, whether through patient consent or other mechanisms, into this type of exchange? That's one type of challenge that those types of organizations are facing. Another type of challenge would be when different hospitals are using different vendor systems, for example, where the information that is within the system may not be stored in a common standard or format. And there it is really how do you start to exchange this information and what's the most critical type of information to be exchanged, things such as medication history, such as a problem list or allergies that would be very useful. Patient history would be another example. And they are working through those types of issues.
Lab tests would be another. Most of the time the lab tests are done at the clinic level before a referral to a hospital, so you wouldn't want the hospital to have to be doing those over again. And, of course, the idea is not to be having to transport all these files all over the place every time the care changes location.
Madam Chair, you are exactly right. Lab tests are one of the more valuable things that can be exchanged. One of the particular challenges around exchanging lab tests, while there are national standards for this, institutions that implement an electronic health record have quite a large degree of flexibility in how they put lab tests and results into their systems. So that tends to be a very non-standard type of information and very difficult to exchange. But that would be a very useful piece of information to exchange.
Senator Pretnick.
Madam Chair, are we communicating with all the hospitals and all the providers, and are we all working toward the same goal? Is this something that the providers want to do too? And do they know that we're moving in this direction and that they're not implementing? Because I know a lot of the hospitals and the clinics are implementing new systems and maybe are on their third generation of e-health records. And I think that they need to be aware that we're trying to get them to interact with one another.
Madam Chair, Senator, in fact, that is part of the department's e-health initiative. As part of the e-health advisory committee, we have pulled together all of the major stakeholders within the system, providers of all kinds, as well as health plans and others. And in fact, we have also done a great deal of outreach to help coordinate and educate providers about opportunities. One of the things that this particular initiative has done is we've held two statewide summits that are specifically for Minnesota providers and health plans. Those activities have been attended by over 400 healthcare industry representatives representing healthcare providers and plans. The department also maintains an e-health website that links to a number, approximately 650 resources at both the state and federal level to help make providers aware of how to connect up and be consistent with standards. So that is very much a concern of ours, as well as the provider community, given the great expense that it takes to implement electronic health records.
And so, Madam Chair, one last question, Mr. Golden. Does it look like we'll be able to do this? I mean, I hear that that's our effort and we're moving in that direction and what the challenges are, but does it look like we'll be able to resolve this and have interactive records?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that it is. I think you have to think about this as kind of a phased process. The first phase is making sure that institutions have electronic health records. While it's certainly true that hospitals have done a very good job at implementing electronic health records, at this point, primary care clinics, for example, would not have implemented to the same extent. So to the degree that those clinics are feeding patients to the hospital, it may be more difficult until those clinics start to implement electronic health records. I think the next phase is then making sure that healthcare providers that have overlapping patients and constituencies are able to share, so that clinics that are feeding into the hospitals and those hospitals can start to exchange the information. And then beyond that, it's connecting up in a broader sense so that the information can appropriately flow through the healthcare system wherever the patient might present for care delivery. So I think it is very possible.
We have created an e-health advisory committee and charged the department through that committee to come up with an interoperable standard for the state of Minnesota. Now, I'm a little frustrated about their slowness. I tend to feel like in the past they've been more of a monitoring committee than they have been an activating committee. And I think before everybody gets e-records in, it would be helpful to know what the interoperability standard is going to be, rather so you could apply it ahead of time rather than trying to apply it after the fact. But we can maybe get some more information from that advisory committee for members to look at. Senator Olson?
Is part of this initiative making it easier for the patient to access their own records electronically? Or is it just for the benefit of hospitals and medical providers being able to share records among themselves?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, no, in fact, very much part of this is a very consumer and patient-centric initiative to try to make the information very available for them. Many of the organizations, particularly those larger organizations in the metro area that have a great deal of experience with electronic health records, have implemented a number of ways that the patient can access their record. Personal health records, MyChart is an example of those, that allows them to access their records electronically over a secure connection over the internet, and also allows them to more easily share those records with other healthcare providers as well.
Senator Sharon?
I would like to ask, thank you, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask again about the process of bringing everyone in the state into a system in which this information can be communicated. And I understand the cost and expense is an issue. I understand that the language, so that it's similar between the systems, is an issue, and I understand privacy is an issue. But I'm wondering, as a new, I do not know whether, is this going to be a required kind of consistency and redundancy system in the state? Is that the goal, to require all systems to engage in this interactive communication for the purposes of health cost savings and reduction of error? And is there a goal date established in the state to achieve this, that everybody has to be in compliance with something like this at a certain goal date? How are these other than encouragements, you know, that this is a good idea? Is there a plan laid out, and is there some muscle behind that as well as dollars to make this happen?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, I don't believe at this point there is a date-specific mandate in law. The eHealth Advisory Committee has made a number of recommendations regarding trying to have all hospitals and primary care clinics to have an electronic health record in place by 2012 as a date. So at this point, there is no requirement that mandates it. I would say, however, that I believe all of the healthcare providers see tremendous benefit to having this type of system, so that they can, in fact, get the best information about their patients that they have available at the time that they're delivering the care. So I think that many of the providers in the state are very interested and eager to try to implement these types of ideas. I think they're just very worried about the cost associated with implementing these, and then just the difficulty of connecting to other systems.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon, there was a date in the Senate bill. We could barely get the House to create the advisory committee, so there was no date in the final legislation.
Madam Chair, one follow-up question, which really I think follows what the Chair was saying. It's confusing to me as well as to why we would not establish the vision, the long-term image of how this is going to look, so that as people are working towards the objective, they're investing in systems that fit the whole. What I am understanding you to say is that everybody sort of is encouraged to do something in order to get involved in technological communications, but that there's not a futuristic roadmap that helps the person say, what we purchase and invest in today defines things in the same way, so that when we're communicating, we're talking about the same thing, and is in a system that is compatible, so that people throughout the state can communicate with one another.
Madam Chair, Senator, perhaps I misspoke. I believe that the eHealth Advisory Committee is setting that vision of a long-term goal for what we want for the state, and in fact is tying into standards to the degree and level that they exist today. So, for example, all of the grants that we distributed with last year's appropriation, any activity did need to be consistent with the national standards that are set at the federal level currently and are continuing to be refined. I think part of the difficulty is that those standards are only partially defined. So while we want to be consistent with those efforts and have that as part of our long-term goal, those are going to continue to be further refined and developed as we go forward. So we want to make sure where we are today is consistent with those activities moving forward. And I think that is one of the major goals of the eHealth Advisory Committee and the vision that they're trying to lay out for the state.
And do we have any idea when the federal government will have finished with their work in terms of defining standards?
Madam Chair, they have already issued the first set of standards as it relates to ambulatory electronic health records. I don't have it in front of me, but I believe that the next two portions of standards will be completed by the second or third quarter of 2008.
So that's part of our problem. Any other questions? Senator Olson?
Would the Health Economics Office have available the amount of money that we're currently spending on copying medical records? Has that?
That would be buried in the administrative costs. But you can find out from individual organizations that have implemented e-health records how much they saved in terms of no longer having to transport the records. Savings go beyond that, however, you know, in terms of quality of care issues as well.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Let's continue then.
Okay, Madam Chair. I think moving down just one step below the e-health line within the table there is the director's office. The director's office is responsible for the general management and oversight of the division's five programs. This office is funded in some degree by all of the division's various funding sources. Within the director's office, we have three primary responsibilities. As I say, the general oversight and management of the programs, which would include providing budget planning and development, financial management, human resources assistance, as well as data practices oversight. The other two major activities that are done through the director's office is the administration of the adverse health events reporting system. This was established in 2003 and requires hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, and regional treatment centers to report one of 27 serious events whenever these take place.
So is the administration of that program funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund?
Madam Chair, no, it's not. That is funded out of the state government special revenue line. That is, if you go across the director's line, there's $335,000. That's the adverse events reporting. That is funded through a fee on hospitals and surgical centers, and there's 1.3 FTEs associated with that program. By far, the bulk of that money goes out in a contract to Stratus Health to assist in the analysis of the causes of adverse events and steps that can be taken to avert them in the future. The other activity that is coordinated through the director's office, which is not actually on this chart because of the funding source, is the administration of the Medical Education and Research Cost Fund. That is also through the director's office and has 1.6 FTEs. that is funded through the Special Revenue Fund, which is associated with the Merck funds itself. Moving on to the two programs that I skipped, going back up, there's the Office of the State Registrar. The Office of the State Registrar is responsible for the overall management of Minnesota's centralized registry of birth and death records. It includes the collection, retention, and security of all vital records associated with our 70,000 births and 38,000 deaths annually. Additionally, this is the office that maintains the official permanent state birth and death records for approximately 8 million individuals. The activities within this office would be registering all of the state births consistent with the National Center for Health Statistics guidelines. Additionally, we participate with the Social Security Administration to allow parents to get a Social Security number for their child as part of the birth registration process. Another major activity would be adding fathers to the birth records. Approximately 30% of Minnesota's births are to an unmarried parent, and so consequently to put a father onto the birth certificate requires either a recognition of parentage form or a court-ordered paternity adjudication. In 2005, we accepted approximately 16,000 recognition of parentages, as well as 2,500 paternity adjudications to amend the birth record. Additionally, we also amend and correct birth records based on notices that are sent after the initial data is brought in. Other activities would be death registration. We have approximately 38,000 deaths annually. Those are registered consistent with the National Center for Health Statistics guidelines. Minnesota also participates with the Social Security Administration in verifying a decedent's Social Security number and reporting that to the Social Security Administration. One of the major activities of this office would be the issuance of birth and death certificates. Between the Office of the State Registrar and the local registrars, we issue approximately 650,000 birth and death certificates annually to Minnesota citizens. The other activity that is in the Office of the State Registrar is it administers the Father's Adoption Registry. This is a registry that allows men who believe they will be or will become fathers to register for a notice of an impending adoption. The funding for the Office of the State Registrar is in total approximately $4.1 million and has 38.6 FTEs. Of that, $3.663 million and 32 FTEs is on the state government special revenue and is fee supported from the issuance of birth and death records. Another $487,000 and approximately 6 FTEs are contracts that are associated with the Department of Human Services as well as the National Center for Health Statistics. The final program within our division is the Center for Health Statistics. The Center for Health Statistics collects, analyzes, links, and disseminates data on the health of Minnesotans that help provide information for policies and programs to improve the health of Minnesota citizens. The types of activities that are within this center would be such things as the CDC's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, which is a state-specific survey that collects information on asthma, diabetes, healthcare access, alcohol use, hypertension, obesity, cancer screening, and other health conditions. It also administers a pregnancy risk assessment monitoring system, which is also a CDC program that looks at ways to improve the health of mothers and infants by reducing adverse outcomes such as low birth weight, infant mortality, and morbidity. This is the program that is also responsible for the Minnesota Youth Tobacco Survey. Other responsibilities would include maintaining and running the Department of Health's Institutional Review Board, which is responsible for ensuring that MDH follows ethical principles and federal guidelines with the regard to the protection of human subjects in research. And finally, this program also does data collection and reporting associated with the Women's Right to Know. The overall budget for this particular program is approximately $1.2 million and 16 FTEs. The bulk of that funding is federal funds, which is $762,000 and 11 FTEs. And then the remainder is the general fund, which you see on the table, which is approximately $400,000 and 5.1 FTEs.
And do we have any information on how we're doing with reducing our youth smoking? I think both where are we today as compared to where we were in 2003, and then where were we planning to be before that?
Madam Chair, when we reported in front of the committee last year, we had met the goal in statute to reduce smoking by 25%. We have continued to assume that we are to continue in that same frame. We have not gotten a new goal, but we have been assuming that we are to continue to try to reduce it by another 25% over the next 4 years. We've worked with that assumption.
And what were we hoping we would reduce it when we had the endowment?
30%.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Thank you. Several years ago, and I don't know if anybody has the answer to this question, and I guess it's okay if you don't, but several years ago you implemented a new program as far as death certificates are concerned. And I, at the time, there was a lot of bugs in the system, and I had several calls from funeral directors who were having problems with that system. I'm wondering if that's up, is it everything running smoothly? Do you know that at all? Or
Madam Chair, Senator, we have worked out many of the bugs within that system. We have worked quite closely with the funeral directors to try to address some of their issues and more completely integrate that electronic filing into their normal business processes. One of the things that we anticipate to be happening is at the federal level, they will be introducing some new regulations associated with birth and death certificates. That's anticipated to be part of protection of identity. It has a lot to do with identity theft and those types of issues. As part of that, one of the things we anticipate doing over the next 2 to 4 years is implementing an updated electronic birth and death certificate reporting system. As part of that, we will address any remaining issues that we have with the funeral directors, as well as bring them in very early in the process to make sure that any design changes can more fully integrate in so that it's actually trying to consider their needs up front as opposed to retrofit a system after we've already built it and didn't fully accommodate their needs.
And Madam Chair, I would just say thank you to Mr. Golden for your comments on that, and I'm glad to hear that you're going to ask the funeral directors to come and give input instead of putting forward a program that they had no input in. I think that it's important to work with them to figure out something that's going to work for the department and for the funeral director. So I thank you for that.
Why don't we continue?
That's all I have.
Madam Chair, I apologize for jumping out of order. I am sometimes collation challenged, and it came out last night. We are going to move to page 9 of your handouts, which describes the funding for the Compliance Monitoring Division. Darcy Miner is coming to the table to walk you through the detail. This division is funded with a variety of funding sources, both general fund dollars that are appropriated by the legislature, fee revenues, which are also appropriated by the legislature, and a significant amount of federal funding. And as you look on this chart, it describes where our dollars are spent. It doesn't necessarily describe where our dollars come from. Our dollars are all combined into one account in the Miscellaneous Special Revenue Fund, which is the other funds section, the black section of that pie chart. Because our survey activity is supported in part by fees assessed against providers, it's supported in part by state general fund dollars and by contracts with the federal government, we combine all those resources into one fund for operational administration, administrative simplicity. And so what you see on this chart is that a combination of the general fund, other funds, and fee revenues really reflects the bulk of the activity of this division, the survey activity and licensing and certification activity that is supported by a variety of sources. There is a small sliver of healthcare access funds in this division. It's not supporting necessarily the work of this division, but those activities are organized across multiple divisions and supervisory activities in this division, which is why they're showing up here. Those funds are actually supporting work that happens in health policy. All of the funding in this division remains at the Department of Health for the activity we do at the department. There aren't any grants that go out under this division. And if you will go back to page 7, or just back to page 8, you'll see the detail of the appropriated dollars for this division that Darcy Miner will walk you through.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Darcy Miner, and I'm the Division Director for Compliance Monitoring. Through regulation in a variety of programs, we strive to keep Minnesotans healthy and safe in various settings at various phases of their lives. We are a diverse number of programs, but the regulatory aspect is what we have in common across the division. The lines that are shown on that page, as Margaret was indicating, our funding is rather complicated, and so I'm going to walk you through some of the activities, but it's hard to distinguish exactly which of those survey activities are funded by which funding source. So I'm going to try and cover them more generally. For example, the Medicaid survey line, the activities there are very similar to the activities on the licensing and certification line. However, the funding sources are different depending on the type of facility that we're actually inspecting. The activities in the Medicaid survey are conducted under contract with the state's Medicaid agency, the Department of Human Services. Under that contract, the Health Department conducts unannounced surveys and certification activities for nursing homes and for ICF's MR. We also do assessments and audits for the Case Mix Review Program. There are 392 federally certified nursing home facilities in the state of Minnesota. There are another 12 boarding care homes that are state licensed only and don't participate in Medicaid. Among those, the vets home that you've had hearings about recently. Under federal requirements, we survey or inspect nursing homes on an average of every 12 months, though we may go in anywhere between 9 and 15 months and still be consistent with federal requirements. For state licensure, we must survey nursing homes every 24 months, and therefore every other year when we go into survey, we are surveying for the requirements to meet both federal and state certification and licensure. There are 222 intermediate care facilities for mentally retarded or ICFs MR, and to retain federal certification, they must be surveyed every 12 months. In addition to the nursing homes and ICFs, our survey staff also survey a total of 73 hospitals, which are a variety of accredited, non-accredited, and other specialized. We also survey home care providers, assisted living home care providers, hospice providers, freestanding ambulatory surgical centers, supervised living facilities, supplemental nursing staffing agencies, and other miscellaneous providers such as those who provide kidney dialysis and also rural health clinics. And of the list that I just gave you, that is a combination of fee-supported and federal Medicaid-supported. The requirements for the frequency of inspections for those various facilities vary anywhere from the year that I mentioned before for nursing facilities up to 10 years, depending on the type of facility. Also included in this broad activity of surveys and licensing and certification is a contract with the State Fire Marshal's Office. While our staff survey facilities for compliance with federal health guidelines, the State Fire Marshal's staff is under contract with us to survey for compliance with the Life Safety Code. That contract is managed through our engineering services section. There are five engineers on our staff. They conduct plan reviews and construction inspections for nursing homes and for hospital construction projects. In state fiscal year 06, they conducted reviews and inspections for approximately 170 projects. So far in state fiscal year 07, they've conducted plan reviews for over 90 projects. Licensing and certification staff work in teams and are located both in the metro area, which is about 40% of our staff, and also 60% of the staff is located in health department district offices around the state. We have locations in Bemidji, Duluth, Fergus Falls, Mankato, Rochester, and St. Cloud. All team members are qualified to conduct surveys in the nursing facilities. Some of the other facilities that we survey require specialized training, and only some of our survey staff have received that training. We have a total of 61 surveyor FTEs. As I'd mentioned, the licensing and certification activity is tied very closely to Medicaid surveys. We also include within that broad area not only the engineering that I mentioned, but the Office of Health Facility Complaints, or OHFC. In the OHFC program, complaint investigators, all of whom are nurses, respond to complaints about nursing facilities and hospitals. In order to begin an investigation of a hospital, however, we must get direct authority from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. An investigation will often look at both whether there are any federal requirements that were not met and also whether the State Vulnerable Adults Act has been violated, and therefore, again, there's a mixture of funding supporting this activity. Currently, we are uncertain about the level of federal funding that we'll be receiving. We are receiving funds under a continuing resolution, which is providing us the same level of funding as we had in the previous fiscal year. We had been told by the CMS regional office that we would likely receive roughly a 2% increase for fiscal year 07, but until a federal budget is actually approved, we will not see any increase. We'll simply operate under the same level. Because of increasing costs, both in staffing costs and in gasoline costs for travel, because our staff travel all around the state, we have taken some steps to reduce our costs in anticipation of having some shortfall. Among those steps that we've taken, we have reduced the average number of hours for a nursing home survey from roughly 145 hours down to 130 hours. We've also modified our revisit policy to nursing homes. Previously, we had conducted on-site revisits for just about any deficiency that had occurred. Effective surveys that were exited on or after November 3rd of 2006, we've revised that procedure so that there are a list of mandatory revisits, including if there's a certain severity of a deficiency or if it's a repeat deficiency 2 years in a row, and a few other mandatory revisits. We have a small number of random revisits that are just generated by our computer program that even if you don't fall into that mandatory area, we may still come and do an on-site revisit. And the remainder of our revisits will be desk audits or paper reviews where we will not be going out if there are not more serious deficiencies. We've also reduced the number of our OHFC investigators from 16 to 13, and we've reduced our survey positions from 72 to 61. We are hopeful, and our current calculations suggest that with the reduction in hours, that we will be able to continue to do and to meet all of our required surveys within the time allotments with the given staff. Moving on to Medicaid reviews, under this agreement, our health department staff determine resident reimbursement classifications under case mix. The case mix classification determines then the daily rate that a nursing home is paid for that resident's stay. There's a federally prescribed assessment process that is completed quarterly by nursing home staff to determine the case mix classification. Our case mix staff then conduct on-site audits at each nursing home for at least 15% of the residents to verify that those current assessments have been done accurately. In addition, individual residents or their representatives may request reconsideration if they believe that their current assessment has been done inaccurately. Effective last October 1st, as a result of legislative change, the quarterly assessments that are done are now being used on a quarterly basis to determine the rates. Prior to that, although the assessments were done quarterly, we only adjusted rates every 6 months. And with the change that was enacted last year, we are now adjusting those rates on a quarterly basis. Our case mix system, in an effort to become more efficient, has been using a secured computerized system that is virtually paperless. And we have 10 nurse reviewers who are located both in the metro area and also around the state to do those case mix reviews. I'm moving on to vulnerable adults. The special revenue budget for this item covers staffing both to conduct background studies and also vulnerable adult at complaint investigations. Those also have a federal component, and so again, there is a match involved in funding these activities. The background study unit is part of the Office of Health Facility Complaints, and the staff conducts reviews of requests for reconsideration. These requests are submitted by individuals who have been disqualified from providing direct care services or from having any access to vulnerable persons in programs or facilities which are licensed by the health department. A determination is made by that unit to either set aside or not set aside the disqualification to allow the individual to work in a particular employment setting. In fiscal year 06, the unit, which currently and since its inception has been two FTEs, the unit completed 1,190 reconsideration requests. In fiscal year 07, through the end of the calendar year, December 31st, we had already completed 910, so we are on track for many more than what we had in fiscal 06. There have been an increasing number of requests for reconsideration for a variety of reasons. In August of 2004, a law was changed to allow DHS to disqualify individuals based on findings which were done at the county level, and that has increased the number. In addition, there were changes in 2005 that increased the number of disqualifications and therefore the number of individuals who request reconsiderations of those disqualifications. We have redirected resources within our division, and we are in the process of hiring an additional FTE to address some of the increases in those requests. As I mentioned, since the program began in 1995, we've operated with just the two FTEs. Currently, we are not fully up to date within the statutory timeframes. We are roughly 6 to 8 weeks behind in getting to those reviews. Our current backlog is almost 400 studies. Staff from this unit also coordinate our appeals process for maltreatment hearings and involuntary nursing home discharges. Our appeals coordinator testifies at hearings which involve disqualification appeals. The background checks portion of this area of the vulnerable adults is funded through a contract with the Department of Human Services. DHS conducts approximately 142,000 background studies annually, of which approximately 3,400 applicants are disqualified. Background studies are conducted not only on direct care staff, but also for cooks, housekeepers, maintenance staff, clerical workers, and others who would be in facilities where they would have access to various vulnerable adults. Managed care systems. Our managed care system regulates 9 health maintenance organizations and 3 county-based purchasing entities. Included within that umbrella, there are nearly 1 million HMO members who are in fully insured or public programs as of 2005. We also have over 28,000 members covered under county-based purchasing plans. The program is responsible for licensing HMOs as well as for ongoing monitoring for continuing compliance with laws and rules that govern quality assurance, financial solvency, and other consumer protection issues. We do a quality assurance exam of each of the HMOs and county-based purchasing entities once every 3 years. That entails an on-site quality assurance exam. We also do financial exams on-site every 3 years, but we have contracted that function to the Department of Commerce because we felt that they are better able to review the plans for financial solvency and other fiscal issues. The Department of Finance does ongoing financial analysis, and we, as I mentioned, do ongoing quality assurance reviews. We also do complaint investigations. Program staff investigate complaints that come from either HMO or county-based purchasing enrollees. There were 169 completed complaint investigations in 2006. Complaints cover a wide area of subjects. They can include the quality of care, access to care, claims and payment issues, and sometimes the pharmaceutical issues. We do other contract and review as well for those HMOs and county-based purchasing. We review their contracts with other providers that provide services to members, and we also do an analysis of those documents when they file them for various purposes. Health Occupations Program. The Health Occupations Program is responsible both for policy analysis and for regulation of a variety of health-related occupations that are not currently credentialed, also for credentialing various allied healthcare occupations, for following up on investigations of those, and for enforcement of professional and ethical standards required for a variety of healthcare occupations. Included in the activities of the Health Occupations Program, we do, as I mentioned, policy analysis and provide information to legislators and staff and also to various health occupations that may be considering whether they want to be certified or they would like licensure, and they will consult with staff to try and understand better what that means. Our Office of Complementary and Alternative Healthcare Practice regulates the activities of unlicensed, complementary, alternative healthcare occupations, primarily practitioners of massage and naturopathic healing arts. At the moment, we have 32 open investigations in that area. Staff also certify hearing instrument dispensers. We issue the examination and review credentialing of dispensers and also approve continuing education reports that are submitted by them. Further, our staff pursue complaints of hearing instrument dispensers in the conduct of their selling hearing aids to individuals. We have staff that license, we issue the exam for occupational therapy practitioners and for occupational therapy assistants, and as in the other areas, we also then approve their continuing education reports and follow up on any consumer complaints of conduct in practitioners in those areas. Finally, the Health Occupations Program is responsible for the licensing of speech-language pathologists and audiologists, and also follow up on their continuing education requirements and any complaints that come in regarding the conduct of practitioners in the providing of services. The final program in our division is mortuary science. Mortuary science licenses and regulates 550 funeral establishments across the state. In addition, we license 50 crematories and 1,475 individual morticians. The section works with approximately 50 new individuals that have graduated from mortuary science programs and who are seeking initial licensure in the state of Minnesota. In addition, we deal with individuals who may come here from other states who have been licensed in other states and wish to become licensed in Minnesota. We conduct the state board examinations, and we also coordinate the clinical and practical internship programs that are part of initial licensure. As was mentioned in a previous presentation, there are approximately 37,000 deaths per year in Minnesota, and this section has the responsibility to ensure that there is timely and appropriate disposition of the dead. The section conducts 375 inspections a year and also completes 50 investigations per year. The state cremation rate has increased from 25% in 1997 to roughly 40% last year, and the number of crematories has increased from 23 back in 1997 to more than double that, to 51 during the same time period. The section also monitors our pre-need trust accounts, which total currently over $70 million, and it is the section's responsibility to make sure that consumers' monies are safe and protected and, in fact, used for the purpose in which they were entrusted. Finally, the mortuary science section reviews and approves continuing education programs and also monitors the ongoing continuing ed for all of its licensees. The final line there, our cross-bureau support, as Margaret mentioned, is actually, there are two activities within there, and one of them is the healthcare clearinghouse. The healthcare clearinghouse, which is tied to our health maintenance, the managed care system, took approximately 1,000 calls in fiscal year 06, and it was through that clearinghouse that we received the 169 complaints that we closed. Basically, the clearinghouse is a place that HMO and county-based purchasing members can call to find out where they can take a complaint, whether there is an appeal system within their plan or if they if there's somewhere else that they can go. They also are advised, sometimes if they are not HMO members but they have a challenge to a provider, the clearinghouse can still direct them to other forms of assistance. The most common complaint issues that we received through the clearinghouse were exclusions and uncovered expenses, prescription drugs, and quality of care. There's also some minor support in there for a cross-bureau planning position that has supported us across the Bureau in such areas as continuation of operations, which was formerly our business continuation planning, our data protection, and also regulatory reform. As I'd indicated, because the kind of the single theme that permeates across all of our programs in the division is the fact that we're all regulatory programs, we continually strive to see if there are systems or methods being applied in one area of regulation that we can learn from and apply to one of our other program areas. And so we've had some staff assistance in doing that. And
The other activity area is the Healthcare Access Fund is compliance monitoring. Can you just tell me what that is, what that does?
Madam Chair, the healthcare access funds in this division do not support the work of this division, but support the work of health policy. Because that person is a part of the cross bureau, works between the two bureaus, part of that person's time is spent in another division, the reporting of that person is in compliance monitoring, and so the reporting of her whole salary is in this area, but the healthcare access fund portion of those salary dollars actually support health policy.
Maybe we could get a job description. We could understand it better.
Sure.
Then. Other questions? Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Miner?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. A couple questions on the mortuary science division. You said that there's 50 new funeral directors a year. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding.
And then do you track at all whether, you know, how many, you know, like if the people graduate from the program, how many people stay in the program? And then do you feel that we in Minnesota, we have an adequate amount of funeral directors to cover the needs of the 37 or 38,000 deaths a year?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not certain that we track individuals other than that we do an annual relicensure, and that is accomplished online. We then monitor to make sure that individuals have paid their licensure fee, and as I indicated, we do track to make sure that they've done their continuing education, but I don't know that we track them as a group of graduates, if you will, and follow them going through. Once they join the pool of morticians, mm-hmm. we could pull them up by name, but not necessarily by how long they have been in the practice.
And then, Madam Chair, is there ever any discussions? I know I think, and I don't know if I'm exactly sure on this, but in 37 other states, you don't have to be licensed to do a removal. And I know, for example, in Florida and South Dakota, just off the top of my head, those are states that don't require that. And I know that the National Funeral Directors Association has talked about maybe a two-tiered licensure where, you know, you'd be licensed just specifically for removal, and then the other licensure would be for embalming and making arrangements and so on and so forth. And the reason why I bring this up is I just a little concerned, you know, that we have adequate coverage here in Minnesota. And, you know, let's just say a hypothetical, which I don't think is going to happen, anything on the bird flu, but just hypothetically, just in case it did, you know, just let's just say if we had 1% of the population get sick and die, we have 5 million people, that'd be 50,000 people over and above the regular deaths. There would be no way that the funeral directors could handle that surge. And so I imagine that we would go to, you know, the governor would activate the National Guard or something. But then there again, you're having people that are not trained in bloodborne and airborne pathogens, and so I imagine that you've probably got this all figured out already. But I'm just wondering if the department has ever considered a two-tier licensure program, or if you ever discussed that.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that our staff have had discussions in the past with the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association about that. I was unaware that it was so prevalent in so many other states, but so far I think we have we've not been inclined to support that. However, to your point about would there be enough licensed morticians, should there be some kind of emergency, be it the bird flu or something else, we have had one of our staff has been working very closely with the Emergency Preparedness Office. He's also been assigned to work with the mobile morgue, which is one of the other steps that we've taken in case of such a possibility. I think that, and he's also spoken to the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association to give them some of the numbers, such as those that you referenced about as we look at parallels between now and the last great influenza pandemic and what those numbers would mean, and trying to give them some idea of what they would have to be contending with. And so far, at least, that has not moved them, that I'm aware, to look at a two-tier licensure. But I think it has been a discussion that continually comes up.
Now, Madam Chair, Ms. Miner, does the department take positions on these different issues as this, the two-tiered licensure idea? Do you guys take a position on that? Or I wouldn't think that departments would take a position on something like that.
Madam Chair and Senator, we haven't taken a position. We are simply, we look at what the impact would be on our licensure requirements and for the staffing that we currently have to mm-hmm. do that. So, no, we haven't stepped into that fray.
Okay. All right. Thank you for those.
Any questions on this? Okay, then let's move on.
Madam Chair, that was what we had prepared for today.
Okay. So
we have additional staff who were planning to come tomorrow to finish the rest of our budget.
All right. So, members, if you can leave your materials in your folders, because you will need them tomorrow, and we're not planning on duplicating them again. Thank you very much. And with that, the meeting will be adjourned.